Welcome to the Africa Tech Summit podcast, sharing insights from across the African tech scene. Today's episode is part of our Africa Climate Tech Summit series, which is kindly supported by Mercy Corps Ventures and Pure Carbon in partnership with the 6th D. Stay tuned for great insights and a discount code to join us at the Africa Climate Tech Summit in Nairobi.
My name is Boko Inyundo, founder of the 6th D. In today's episode, we're exploring the nexus between energy, fintech, and development with Nthabi Musia, co-founder and CCO of Easy Solar. Welcome, Nthabi.
Thanks, Boko. Really glad to be on.
Fantastic. Well, if I could ask you to perhaps introduce yourself, give us a sense of the background to Easy Solar and your role with the business.
Yeah, sure. So I'm the co-founder of Easy Solar, a company I started with my two business partners back in 2016. We're on a mission to light up lives through solar, and our vision is of a world where energy and financial services are affordable and accessible for all. We started the company primarily because of a huge challenge of energy access in Africa. So around 570 million people on the continent lack access to formal electricity. And in 2023, I still think that's quite a big injustice, as I did back in 2016. And sadly, at the current pace of electrification, we're set to have a similar amount of people without electricity by 2030. So there's still a lot of way to go. But our contribution has really been to try and solve that energy access problem by making energy affordable and accessible for all. And we do that, we make it accessible through a network of agents and shops that we train up who are based in the communities they serve. And we make it affordable by providing solar systems on what we call a rent-to-own financing scheme enabled by smart technology. And yeah, so basically people can go into one of our agents or stores, choose a payment plan that fits them, and then, you know, over 6 to 24 months, pay off a solar home system, after which the energy is free and we provide after sales service and maintenance. So really a plug and play, quite simple distribution based business that's really trying to solve a really big problem in Sierra Leone and Liberia, primarily where we operate.
And give us a sense of the scale of your impact so far in terms of the numbers of people and or customers that you've supported in terms of getting access to solar.
Sure. So maybe just to give you a scale of the problem, when we started, around 95% of the population in Sierra Leone and Liberia lacked access to electricity, which is insane to say. Roughly now it's around 75%, but still quite a significant proportion of people off-grid. And so we're looking at about 1 million households in Sierra Leone and roughly around 800,000 in Liberia when, you know, overall, that we were, you know, really our addressable market. And so far we've provided electricity to about 200,000 households. So roughly around 1 million people when you do the maths. And we've done this really by establishing a network of around 400 distribution points across both countries. Of community-based agents, but then also stores in more peri-urban areas. And we have about 300 full-time staff. So it's quite a big operation, but we're really, you know, really passionate not just about providing energy, but also, you know, the after-sales, customer care. And so that does require quite a big workforce to keep the lights on.
Fantastic. That's great to hear, and that scale is humbling. Give us a sense of what inspired you to do what you do. Where did you find inspiration for this? You've mentioned, obviously, your appreciation of the addressable market and the problem and the challenges and what you're trying to solve. But, you know, go back in time and give us a sense of how you arrived at this as your vocation, as it were.
Yeah, sure. I think, interestingly enough, I always think people who are part of a broken system or who've experienced a broken system, there's two options. Either you feel very powerless and don't understand why you were born or raised in a situation where you lack access to resources others don't, or you can actually be the best position to actually find the cracks and understand the reasons for that and, you know, use the available solutions to solve it. So I think growing up, I was definitely of the first mindset of not understanding why power was not stable in my home. So just feeling a bit disenchanted because my family couldn't afford a generator. And yeah, having to scramble for like candles when the grid would go out. Thankfully, it wasn't very often, like growing up. Now it's gotten quite bad. So I grew up in South Africa, and so the grid has really just deteriorated over time. But yeah, I think that experience definitely haunted me, I would say. But I think probably the more formative part from like a career perspective is when I was quite fortunate enough to be working as a management consultant across the continent. And every country I was, you know, working in, you know, power was not something that was stable, universally accessible, reliable, and affordable. And for me personally, just from like a human perspective, I've always never really understood why Africa is seen as a basket case in need of saving, why we're so far behind, and really was thinking about how I can contribute to the continent's development. And I really thought if we fix this power issue, really it's the foundation of so many modern economies. And you know, I thought that could be my contribution. And I looked at it from both the residential, commercial, and industrial level. And I didn't have those answers. So I went to grad school in the States. It was one of the best energy programs that I found to try and solve that problem. And the goal was always to come back and find my niche. It happened to be entrepreneurship, which was not the plan. I really thought I was going to be helping either on the project finance or policy side to build like large solar and wind farms. I was always passionate about renewable energy. But yeah, actually stumbled into entrepreneurship kind of by accident while I was at grad school.
Really interesting journey, both your personal experiences of access to power, but also your academic experiences, which then triggered your thinking as to where exactly your niche might be. Now, our audience won't necessarily have done the desk research to appreciate the background in terms of your investors. So those backing Easy Solar with the financial capital and technical assistance to enable you to do what you do over the last few years. Where you're able to, where it's public, can you give us a sense of who your investors are and perhaps a little bit of insight into relationships and the way you work and how you collaborate together to deliver solutions for your end beneficiaries?
Yeah, I think we really started off quite early, trying to be quite intentional about how we raise money and kind of the capital stack, so to speak. So really early on, when we were still in grad school, we were primarily grant funded. So that was really about like, you know, testing our pilot and kind of validating the business model. So we entered some business plan competitions and then, you know, used that kind of as like our pre-seed funding. And then, yeah, kind of progressively looked for external capital from like more institutional investors. So yeah, and then we started our seed round from Acumen in 2017, who's a, you know, quite a patient early stage investor. And that was quite transformational, I think, just because, you know, Acumen's approach is really to nurture their entrepreneurs. As I said, very patient capital, not necessarily after like crazy growth and crazy returns, at least initially. And so that helped us really, like, you know, sort of in the beginning stages, really focus on kind of the foundational aspects of the business, which I think really helped us when we, you know, from 2018, I'd say, to 2021, we had really quite significant growth. You know, we went from around $800,000 in revenue to about $7 million, in that period. And really growing, you know, both our staff and, operational capacity comparatively, through that scale. And in 2020, we brought on, in addition to Acumen, we brought on FMO, who, yep, are the Dutch, sort of the Dutch government development financing arm. And then Gaia, who's an impact fund, French impact fund, which is they're very well-versed in the energy space. And yeah, they've brought on, I think, that expertise, not just looking at standalone solar home systems, but they've got mini grid companies, they've got CNI companies as well. So that was really helpful. I would say our relationships, depending on the investor, they're quite different. As I said, Acumen's a lot more patient, a lot more about nurturing entrepreneurs. I think FMO, you know, typically, interestingly enough, they come in at much bigger ticket sizes and typically later stage. And so we were quite kind of like an earlier, stage investment for them. So it's been quite interesting being able to work with an investor that I think is quite rigorous, is quite demanding, but I think has helped us and pushed us to especially from a corporate governance perspective, and, you know, really on the growth side, be a bit more aggressive. And I think Gaia is somewhere in between the two. In addition to that, we have got some debt financing from Hemix. We've done the crowdfunding through platforms like Trine. We've also, brought in some concessional or somewhat de-risked debt through an organization called Cordaid, which is also Dutch-based, more impact-oriented. And then in 2021, Lion's Head, which is a off-grid facility through the African Development Bank. So quite a mixed stack. I think in the interim, we've also got some grant funding as well to, test new products, test new innovations that we don't want to necessarily use equity or debt to finance from a risk perspective.
And a real mix as you've journeyed, as you've matured as a business, but whilst also looking for very specific capital to support your innovation in your test and learn in a sense. So, thanks for the colour there. That's really interesting. I'm going to go sort of big picture now and ask you around the questions around how your business is buffeted to some degree by the macro trends. And so what's out there creating challenges for you as you continue your journey of scaling, but also what's opening up opportunities and making you perhaps build new relationships that support your growth?
Yeah, I think as an entrepreneur, we tend to be very skewed towards always framing challenges as opportunities. But I do think the post-COVID world has tested all of us. And so it was interesting. It was in Rwanda a couple of weeks ago, for a program, and it was the first time I think everyone just framed challenges as like kind of systemic, really just like testing our ability to think positively and frame everything as an opportunity. So I think you mentioned inflation, definitely a big one, but I think probably even more so for a lot of companies operating in African markets, probably the currency devaluation has probably been one of the hardest. In Sierra Leone, we had a redenomination last year in September, and we saw the currency really devalued roughly by 50 to 60% within the space of a year. And if you don't have sufficient hedging, it can really destroy a business. We were lucky that some of our debt financing was hedged. So from that perspective, we weren't killed. We weren't destroyed by having to finance interest and principal payments, at almost a significant premium to what we originally got the debt line at. But still, right, I think the devaluation affects almost every aspect of the business, and you're having to work twice as hard to present USD numbers to external investors. So I think that's one that's been really, markets like Nigeria, Ghana, Sierra Leone have been really hard hit. And then inflation means that the basket of goods that people are, buying, shrinks. And energy, I think, thankfully, is still an essential service. So, we've been able, I would say, to maintain our 2021 levels, but I think maintain is kind of the name of the game right now, and survive and push through the current environment, and then, as you said, seek new opportunities, new collaborations, new pathways. So one thing that's really great that we've never really leveraged before is the fact that we are a climate friendly business. And I think following on from COP27, there is a lot more activity, specifically focused on African carbon markets, to try and develop those, to try and get a pipeline of projects that are bankable, that people do want to buy credits from. So that's been something that we've been really exploring more from like a medium term perspective. I would say really tapping into the vast amounts of credit data we have. To look at like complementary services to our existing customer base. So looking really at financial services a bit more as a product category. I would say those are kind of the two that I think are quite interesting and that we're really trying to kind of leverage the existing assets that we have to sustain, not just to sustain, but to I think sort of recover and get to higher growth rates that we've seen historically.
Interesting. And you're seeing a local customer base having a greater awareness of the opportunity of solar as both a play that can help reduce costs, but also net positive for the environment.
I would like to say yes, because I would like to say that everyone is environmentally minded. I do think, especially when we talk about climate in Africa, I think people probably are experiencing the impacts of the climate crisis. But in terms of it being like a decision-making process for how they're purchasing, I think price is still the main determinant. I don't think, you know, with the exception, and I think one thing I didn't mention is that we do have a growing commercial and industrial part of the business, which we call Power Solutions, which is really looking at, you know, NGOs, businesses, you know, factories, farms, that are either looking to become a bit more independent of the grid or less reliant on the grid. And some of those do have like climate goals, right? To be net zero and being able to invest in solar can be a part of their decision or procurement process. But I think at the residential level, it's still quite, how am I going to feed my family? How am I going to survive? What are the trade-offs I have to make? Those trade-offs might be impacted by, you know, forced migration, unstable harvest. So those are all like sort of indirect impacts of climate, but not necessarily driving forces, I think, for how people make decisions. And that's why I think being able to, you know, monetize kind of the climate impact and have that be impacted on the price is the best way we can pass it on to consumers.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, particularly the demographic you're serving and the context in which they're surviving and seeking to thrive requires you to be, primarily focused on how to make energy accessible and affordable first and foremost before one champions, say, the environmental benefits of it as much as obviously the investors and or the commercial customers would see that as key. Okay, I guess carbon credits and your relationship with Carbon Clear. I noticed that from my own preparation for this podcast. I wanted to find out a little bit more about how you established that. It's obviously an innovative move, so give us a bit of background to how it came about and also how that relationship with that Danish technology company is going. Give us a bit of background to that deal.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think the relationship with Carbon Clear, it started actually through USA, Power Africa, which is the US's flagship program for accelerating energy access in Africa. They had a program which was to try and educate solar companies on the options that they have available to them to monetize or benefit from their climate impacts. Carbon Clear was one of the partnering institutions that Power Africa was working with, and they selected three solar companies, if I'm not mistaken, to work with. And so a lot of it actually initially was just like a a bit of an education, going back to school, on what are the options available. And that was about 3 months of work where, you know, they presented their solution, but they also presented options like, you know, developing your own scheme and then you know, sort of like a hybrid model from what they were doing. So yeah, there was kind of three options: working directly with a manufacturer, you know, sort of trying to do the credits directly yourself, or working with an intermediary. And they, you know, presented their solution, I think, as one that was really based on kind of the smart tech aspect. So being able to really look at the metering side of our solar products as a way to be able to track and measure the usage and the kind of scope of systems that were installed. So they're really, really like a climate tech company that, you know, is trying to leverage kind of the pay-as-you-go side of our business. Interestingly enough, we also, our Victron sort of larger installations also have like smart monitoring. So it kind of encompasses the spectrum of what we do. So the work really started as a consultancy. And then we kind of opted in for their solution. It's been a bit slow, if I'm going to be honest. I think part of that is, you know, developing new methodologies, onboarding clients. I think that has been something that has taken a bit more time. And I think in the interim, you know, so we, and part of what they do is they work on the back end of our sort of CRM platform to try and pull out. So it's all data driven. And so, yeah, both the contracting and the data side has taken a bit of time, but I do hope that once we are able to issue the credits and then start, you know, the process of securing buyers, that is something we could potentially pass on to customers. I think on the carbon side as well, in addition to Carbon Clear, we're looking at cook stoves actually. So, you know, we have roughly 200,000 customers. We have a wide distribution network. And cooking projects, I think, are a little bit more, you know, the carbon markets are interesting. I think anybody who's aware of them knows that there is a little bit of skepticism. You know, pricing has, you know, sort of, been a challenge recently. And, you know, being able to verify, there've been a couple of articles and kind of exposés on the validity of some of these credit projects, which I think is great. But I do think cook stoves are kind of, you know, still seen to some extent as solid bankable projects. So that's something we're exploring as well. In addition to the more like cutting edge, more sort of new methodologies that Carbon Clear has on board.
It's fantastic that you're devoting time and energy as a business, as an individual, to explore that as an opportunity to mobilize capital. And in very much probably at a frontier end of that. And so, you know, it's intriguing that you're devoting that time to learning and as and when you begin to issue those credits, you'll learn a bucket more. It'd be interesting to monitor how that goes. I'm now going to ask you more around what's next. As much as you can tell me, and I don't like to put time to it because obviously you then might get hamstrung by it. So if I said looking at the next year or the next 3 years or the next 10 years for the sake of argument, what strategic aspirations do you have for EZ Solar? And if you could give us a little bit of texture around that as much as you can, obviously some of that may be proprietary and confidential, but a little bit of a sense of what's next.
Yeah, sure. So as I said, I think it is a challenging environment at the moment. And so I think I'd be lying to you to say like our ambitions are, you know, bold and, you know, daring. I definitely think, you know, looking at more of like a 5 to 10 year horizon, I do, you know, I'm very excited about where we're going to be at. I think in the immediate 1 to 3 years though, I think really just surviving this macroeconomic storm is one. And being able to lay the seeds for, you know, new future growth opportunities. So, one thing I think is really exciting that, you know, both will support, you know, the future, but then also, you know, provide also additional, I would say stability for where we are now is to do a pilot in Guinea, which has always been our, you know, focus next market. I think we have a couple of other markets on the horizon, but I think Guinea immediately is a really interesting market. Not that much going on the both the kind of the small scale solar, but then also the commercial and industrial side, and a slightly, you know, from like a GDP per capita perspective, slightly more affluent than Sierra Leone and Liberia. So it'll be interesting for us to test the waters of the model there. And then, yeah, kind of sow the seeds for the next couple of markets we have on the horizon. I think an interesting one that everyone is still really excited about and seems to be growing, especially as a couple of countries are removing fuel subsidies and, you know, Russia, Ukraine, there was, you know, fuel prices were definitely impacted. And so the kind of costs of running generators or having hybrid systems has made the commercial and industrial part of our business more attractive, and that's been growing and very profitable. And yeah, even like from a financing and capital perspective, it does open us up to a whole new plethora of investors. So that's kind of a key one for us. And then I was saying kind of on the product development side, both looking at clean cooking, which I think when you look at energy access, it's not just access to electricity, but access to modern cooking, I think, or clean cooking That's also a problem that I think we're trying to solve. So using the kind of climate aspect of that to make it more affordable and more attractive. And then on the other product side, really, as I said before, leveraging our distribution network to look at financial services, so microloans, micro insurance, other kind of financial products that would, benefit our customers and add value, to them, when they've, already finished paying off their system. So I think those are the kind of three, expansion geographically, building on the CNI practice and then testing out some new product development in addition to surviving the macroeconomic storm.
Having started the answer with a kind of humbling, with some humility, you then listed a whole load of really quite challenging things that to keep you busy, whether market expansion into a new country as much as there may be synergies, but also, your product development side of things, that takes time and effort and investment. And then surviving an unprecedented macro environment is well, plenty to get your teeth into there. But but fascinating to hear, and and good luck with it. And given your now several years' experience, I'm sure you'll make a success of it. I'm intrigued as you look to expand into a new country or deepen the penetration of your existing markets in Liberia and Sierra Leone. More go-to-market question, and forgive me, I'm a marketeer, so I have to ask the question. We're in trying to encourage customers to get hold of solar. I mean, my family in Kenya, mum and dad invested in solar for their home in the 1990s, early movers, and the minute we did, we never looked back. That was partly because mum and dad, were tired of waiting for the rural electrification program to happen, and so went for solar just because they loved reading. but once you go that route, it's very difficult to row back because it just makes abundant sense from a cost point of view, for example. In terms of go to market and convincing people, and I'm particularly interested in both looking at the consumer, but also the enterprise, the commercial side, encouraging them to adopt solar. What in your go to market efforts has worked really well? Which you may replicate in a place like Guinea, and where perhaps has there been a surprise that you thought investing in that channel or initiative or messaging to convince people didn't quite work as much as you expected?
It's a great question. So I think I can start with Sierra Leone and Liberia because I think we did try and replicate. The results were not the same, but I think I can talk about the successes of Sierra Leone and then maybe the challenges of trying to replicate. So, when we started, I think really the approach was to listen first and to really understand the pain points. I think really understand what the perspective around solar, around energy was. And so, our assumption that it was all about price and affordability and just, accessibility, right? Which is part of the vision statement. I think quickly when we did a survey, we did a pilot, and then, we thought we had it figured out. We understood kind of the economics of how much people were spending, per week and per month on, what they call stopgap, technologies, so whether it's kerosene, candles, torch lights and batteries or generator fuel. So the idea was always, we're going to be priced a little bit below what people are spending, and then we would, define the payment plans accordingly. And so we trained up our first set of agents and we're like, okay, we're coming in. And it was slow initially, slower than expected. And so we did a couple of focus groups and the people that really had opted in, said, that they, were kind of frustrated, annoyed, irritated, and were willing, kind of like your parents, willing to take a chance. And they were really convinced and they loved it, right? And the people that didn't, but almost everyone that did buy, it took them about 1 to 3 months before they made a purchase. And you know, we thought if they were saving up or whatever it is, but a lot of it was actually, you know, trying to find out within their network and their community whether this is something they could trust. Whether, you know, kind of really trying, you know, because one thing that people had said was they've had a lot of promises. They've had, you know, they were, and Sierra Leone was a market where there wasn't a lot of activity at the time. So not a lot of competitors. And when we started, it was just post Ebola, and the one or two companies that did, were selling those standalone systems, they went under, and there was like a lot of like wasted, sort of abandoned loans. And so the experience was that, okay, people are going to come in, say something, maybe the product works for a bit, but then, you know, who knows how long they'll be there. And so what we really realized was that the focus was not on, you know, energy that's affordable, that will save you, that you can invest, but on power you can trust. And, you know, this brand that is going to be with you on the energy journey. And so if something bad happens, we're here to fix it. And so we were really intentional, not just about the product, which was high quality, but about every, you know, especially in the beginning, anytime there was an issue, anytime there was, you know, technical aspect, being there, you know, meeting our service delivery. So really like the customer experience side of things, because we realize if you know, that when somebody asks for that referral of how has your experience been with this company, and they're one of those early adopters, it's not just like, oh, I love solar, but hey, this company, they're different. They, you know, when something happens, you know, or they call you after you buy the product just to check that the agent is you know, has explained everything to you. And so that's a bit tougher to say, like, oh, there was this kind of campaign or this messaging, but it was really doing what you say repeatedly enough times that that kind of word of mouth and that referral engine, which is really our primary marketing channel, sort of vehicle, if I can say, more than any, you know, above, we don't do much above the line. We do some radio, but then, you know, on the below the line stuff, you know, we can go and directly, you know, do some activations and you know, sort of go door to door. But ultimately, it's about that conversation that happens that we're not a part of, and really building our operational, you know, customer care and sales team so that when they have that conversation, we know it's going to be a positive one. And that took time. That was like a lot of iterations, you know, thinking about how to structure our teams, thinking about how to train them, thinking about how do we become more visible in every field interaction. But over time now, you know, I think if you're on ground, you may see a lot more visible, you know, outdoor advertising and hear us on the radio or see an advert on TV. But the brand was really built in those like hidden interactions and conversations and what happens at home and what happens between the customer and the company, over time. So yeah, I think that's been primarily the vehicle. I think there's little things as well, like making sure all of our stores are branded. The branding is very consistent, you know, top tier level, like kind of, you know, visuals as well. We do some social media, but most of our customers are, you know, really off grid, don't have smartphones. So it is really about that relationship and that interaction. The second part of your question was like, how much of that translated, you know, and can we translate? And I think relationships are, I wouldn't say universal, but I think a good customer experience is something that if you master it, I do think that the benefits are kind of universal. But the question is, can you master it across different contexts? Can you train the teams, you know, in a way that becomes sort of like a company ethos? I would say we had a couple more challenges in Liberia. Probably one, you know, one was just like kind of importing the product and pricing model and really realizing that there's probably a different basket of goods and a different pricing mechanism that was required, and probably not devoting as much time to really making sure the sales team, you know, were kind of those like sort of customer experience champions. And I think there was much more of like, you know, we started Liberia in a high growth period, and so we took a lot of those things for granted. And we're like, oh, everybody understands the brand. Everybody understands how we do things. And probably grew very fast too quickly and kind of had to go back to bare bones and really, you know, focus on those like tiny interactions and those tiny, you know, ways you treat customers, where you talk to them. So we kind of had to reverse engineer back. I would say the approach was correct, but we grew so fast that we kind of thought like, all right, we have one kind of onboarding training, and then we trusted to our sales managers to take care of the rest. And sometimes that was not being translated on. So I think in Guinea, really making sure that that's really, really, really reinforced as a culture, I would say like a company culture, and really building the brand very intentionally, regardless of the market.
Join us at the Africa Climate Tech and Investment Summit in February, part of Africa Tech Summit Nairobi, where African tech connects. Please visit africatechsummit.com/Nairobi for more details and use discount code GREEN, that's GREEN, and receive a discount off delegate passes.
That's fantastic insight, and I appreciate it. I mean, home for me is a very rural part of Western Kenya. I guess in that insight, is it straightforward delivering that, for example, to an investor community that may not have their boots on the ground? Because that can come at a cost. Delivering that, you call them micro conversations, but it's people have to have those conversations with people who perhaps even need to learn about the product, let alone learn about your brand. And all of that does take time. It needs nurturing. It needs a degree of patience. But once it's done, it's a formidable underpinning to the business as you then look to grow, whether it's within that country or beyond, because you learn so much from those conversations, and it's two way. The prospective customer learns a lot too, but often capital can be impatient, and that first, that seed capital can often not want to release the sort of money required to fund the structuring of the sorts of teams needed to be on the ground, to be the trusted person in that village that anyone can come to learn a bit more about the product, or to complain about it not working and actually it turning out to be a quite simple technical issue that can be addressed really quite simply. It's just that the person that bought the product wasn't necessarily cognizant of that. So translating what you've just said to an investor community, particularly an investor that doesn't know you, needs convincing about releasing capital that they haven't released before to you, is that straightforward, or there's some hard yards in there?
Yeah, no, it's definitely not easy. I think definitely I would say like field visits, or like being able to kind of show the reality on the ground. Sometimes it does feel like we're operating in different realities. And so I have found that, going through a due diligence and having investors come on ground and just see the reality of our field operations can help in bridging that gap. But I think, even when they are on board, there are expectations, and key metrics you have to maintain. I think we're still fortunate that Sierra Leone operation is still the bulk of our revenue, and we did build those operations quite well. I think Liberia, similarly, lots of potential. We grew really fast initially. There were some metrics that I think probably we could have done better on had we built those foundations. So if anything, I think we have two experiences of like, hey, we took a bit of time with this one. Look how great it is, even in a challenging environment. And hey, there was pressures to grow. we took what we could, but, we had great numbers, but, ultimately, some of those numbers, one or two years down the line from like a portfolio perspective, you see some kind of deterioration. And so I think investors who understand the what we do, because I think investment is a two-way street, right? It's not just about you getting money, but it's also about you getting people who can add value and who understand some of the complexities and nuances of your business. So I think it's not like obviously an environment where you can pick and choose. and there's like investors raining from the ceilings. But as much as possible, we do try and have it be a two-way street where you understand the dynamics of running a credit energy business, and seeing what, a focus on just one or two metrics at the expense of some of the others means. And so, I think we come to a blend of things that, we all agree on are the baseline of success. And as much as possible, I think we all try and hold each other accountable for that, both from an investor perspective, from setting the expectations, but from us saying, these are the reasons why we're at or above or below. So I think it's best to do that earlier on when, you know, you're trying to secure the investment rather than getting down the line and realizing you have very divergent views on what's important.
Interesting. Thank you. Perhaps my final question now is, looking at you as a female founder, you've been operating Easy Solar for some years and reaching hard to reach markets and delivering technology solutions in a context of, you know, the imperative around us all being better custodians of the environment in terms of solar and renewable energy. In those years, what's your experience been like as a female founder? And that might be in the context of trying to convince people to release capital and or implementing your plans on the ground in the African countries in which you operate. Any insights into how that's been, whether there's been any challenges or surprises in doing so as a female founder?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's been an interesting journey. I think I am a female founder, but I also want to caveat that I'm a female co-founder. And I think the experience of female founders, you know, female-only founder businesses, and I have a couple of, you know, friends that I work with, peers and my mentors that have had very different experiences with to me, where you're female-only versus female in a mixed, you know, gender founding team. And so I probably, you know, have had experiences which are challenging, you know, getting in the door, being able to, I think, seek capital. But I think at the same time, I have also, I think that the way we built our founding team was that we all had very different sets of skills, networks, experience. And so we leveraged on each other's, you know, weaknesses and strengths. And in some areas, you know, maybe if it was me just, you know, vying for capital on my own, might have had a very different experience. Did I not have, you know, two male co-founders who are from the West, right? And then also being able to, you know, have gone, and I was quite intentional about going to a school where I'm going to, you know, sort of, that would open the hallways of power for me. But I always wanted to come back to the continent. I was like, I'm not going to be part of the brain drain. So I think as female founders, especially as African female founders, being very realistic about the way the world works, not in like a kind of depressing, nihilistic, oh, well, this is the way it is, let's all not try to solve anything, but positioning yourself in a way that, you know, you can be part of the success stories, but then also, you know, finding ways to tap into where those pools of capital are, where those networks are. I did it my way. I think other people can find other ways. And so I always, you know, if I'm advising young founders, I'm like, build a good team. That if you don't necessarily have those networks, or, you know, if you're finding it difficult to have those conversations, find a way to get in the door. And, you know, if you're the one having the conversation and maybe the doors are closing in your face, you know, find a way to get in the door and then be part of that conversation. And so that I think was part of my approach. And yeah, I think I have seen a couple of, I think the investment is not necessarily very gender focused or gender friendly. It is still very much male dominated, Western male, I would say, dominated. And so if anything, sometimes I feel like I can be used as a, not a marketing tool, but, you know, leverage as a success story. But I'm like, how's your actual, like, criteria and investment strategy changing? Yes, you can, you know, put Easy Solar as an example of a really great investment in an African-founded, female-founded business. But are you actually identifying the barriers to why there aren't as many, you know, in your portfolio, and actually maybe coming in a bit earlier or providing additional TA where, you know, female founders might not have, you know, some of the aspects that you know, male founder businesses have. So I do try and push people a little bit. It is hard. I think as I mentioned in the conversation, there's a lot of things I'm currently doing. And so, you know, kind of the advocacy side is unfortunately not the bulk of my time, but where I can, I do try and call people out on their, I don't know if I'm allowed to say bullshit on the podcast, but and don't just put us in your, you know, your investment or sort of annual report, but actually like tell us how you're changing your strategy and how you're actually influencing the ecosystem, I think to change, because I still think we're very far from where we should be.
appreciate you're working on lots of fronts where change is necessary but difficult to come by, whether it's the environmental question and convincing investors, customers of the proposition in a world that's screaming, our concern for the environment is today, it's not tomorrow, is necessary. But also on the gender side, the world is how it is and it does need to change. But actually some of that change may be incremental. Sometimes it may be transformational, but, it really depends on the context. And actually, it comes down to the individual conversation that you're having on any given day and just trying to shift that needle, often actually quite gently. But been fascinating talking to you, Dabi. And I feel as if we could carry on quite honestly. But I guess I might have one last question. And this is a sort of creative one. And feel free to answer in whichever way you feel like, or to not answer it at all. But I've been asking all of your peers that I've been interviewing as part of this research for the Africa Tech Summit, and it's really looking ahead at, say, a much longer arc, maybe even 10, 20, 50 years from now. If Africa transitions to net zero without any of the apocalyptic outcomes some envisage, what picture, image comes to mind about Africa in that vision? Or maybe you could argue dream. Because I'm trying to get us to a place where we are really very positive about the prospects for Africa in a world that does successfully transition to net zero environment. What picture comes to mind for you as to what the countries you operate in may look like or become in such a world?
Yeah, I mean, net zero world 2050. Some could argue we need to get there a bit sooner, but let's go with that timeline. I think it's interesting. I think Africa has a really unique conundrum, right? We're being asked to rise above a problem we didn't create, number one. And we're being asked not to copy a blueprint for industrialization and development that almost every continent on the earth has followed, right? Which is cheap, dirty fuel, or cheap, dirty power, right? As the foundation for growth. Because there's two challenges, right? The one is one of energy access, which we definitely need to solve. 60% of our population doesn't have access. So that alone, providing access to the, that amount of people, unleashing their potential, to me, that's why I started the business. Because, I think, universal access to power for everyone means that there, all the things that energy enables, suddenly we can suddenly join not just the second, the third, but the fourth industrial revolution, right? That we're ready. So that I think is one that is super exciting, and I see that alone would unleash Africa's potential at an individual, but then also at a commercial industrial scale. I think that the second, which is, I think more your question, which is if we do it in a way that achieves net zero, and Africa's contributions have been quite small, but suddenly you have a model of a continent that has, provided access to people in a way that is clean and not necessarily harmful to the environment. And so I do think that energy mix will be quite interesting. There's some that argue that it's a bit of an injustice, but the cost curve of solar has come down so much. I think renewable energy technologies just on the, fundamentally are actually cheaper. I think there's a question of fuel and our transportation systems. What do they look like? Green hydrogen is the one everybody's kind of going on about from like a shipping and a kind of manufacturing perspective. But then even like looking at kind of, more electric based, clean transportation systems. And we're starting to see kind of kernels of that in e-mobility and, some of the technological advancements that are happening. So I think it will be a brave new world. I think we're going to have to restructure the way we think about societies, how we build systems, how we build our infrastructure. But I do think it's possible, and I'm in that space. And so I think solar is just one piece of that energy mix and that kind of infrastructure that will look quite different from how we started this industrialization journey back in the late 19th century.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. And I love the phrase you use of unleashing Africa and Africans' potential. I think that puts it in a nutshell, and we're doing all we can to will that future forward. But Ntabi, Thank you very much for this conversation. I've very much enjoyed meeting you and talking to you. And hopefully our audience have enjoyed listening to the podcast too. And looking forward to seeing how Easy Solar progresses over the next couple of years. And also as we progress to the Africa Climate Tech and Investment Summit in Nairobi in February. And obviously the report that we'll be launching as part of this research and this series of podcasts that we'll be releasing over the next few months. So thank you very much for your time, and all the best with your future.
Thank you.
Join us at the Africa Climate Tech and Investment Summit in February, part of Africa Tech Summit Nairobi, where African tech connects. Please visit africatechsummit.com/Nairobi for more details and use discount code GREEN, that's GREEN, and receive a discount off delegate passes. To hear our latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit africatechsummit.com for our upcoming events and news.